It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, a political commentator tells us why he thinks Donald Trump has strengthened the Republican Party.
And speaking of the president-elect, today Donald Trump announced his picks for two of the top positions in his administration, including one cabinet post. Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions is Trump's pick for attorney general, and Kansas Representative Mike Pompeo has been selected to lead the CIA. In addition, Trump also confirmed today he'll choose retired Lieutenant General Michael T. Flynn as his national security advisor.
As with Trump's earlier selections, his picks are coming under scrutiny, especially from Democrats, especially in the case of Sessions, who they say is too extreme on immigration and has a history of being accused of racism. But what do we know about the men selected by Trump today, and what might these picks signal about his administration and future policy choices?
David Cannon is back with us. He's a professor of political science at UW-Madison. David, thanks a lot for joining us.
Good to be with you.
So let's start with Donald Trump's pick for attorney general. Now, Jeff Sessions was Trump's first endorser in the Senate and may have been a close decision maker on policy proposals during the campaign. So why do you think Sessions has emerged as a major player in the Trump campaign?
Well, there seems to be a common thread across Pompeo, Sessions, and Flynn. All three of them were supporters of Trump in the campaign. Sessions and Flynn, very early supporters and some of the key advisors to President Trump during the campaign. Pompeo came on as a somewhat later endorser, but also is on board. And the other common thread is they all three come from the right wing of the Republican Party. You could say even the extreme right wing of the Republican Party. So for folks who were hoping for some more moderate picks, these early important positions definitely are coming from the right wing of the party.
So beyond that, what do we know in particular about Senator Sessions?
Well, one reason that Sessions is relatively controversial, or even very controversial among many Democrats, is his past has a very sort of strong racist past. Back in the 1980s, he was nominated by Ronald Reagan to be a district court judge and was actually turned down by the Senate Judiciary Committee, which was controlled by the Republican Party at the time. And it was only the second time in 48 years at that point that a district court nominee had been turned down by the committee. And so the thing that they focused on were a lot of racially insensitive and frankly racist comments that he made as an attorney in Alabama. And the Judiciary Committee decided at that time that this was just something that they could not trust the impartiality of Jeff Sessions to be a federal judge, and so they turned him down. And then since then, you might remember back when the Trump tape came out earlier in the campaign, Sessions was one of the senators to step forward and defend it, at least to some extent. And this was an interview that happened with the Weekly Standard, a conservative publication. And in that interview, Jeff Sessions said that he didn't think that what was described on the tape by Donald Trump was actually sexual assault, whereas every other person who has listened to that tape and sort of heard what was being said agreed that it, in fact, was sexual assault under the definition of any state law. And this is the person now who will be the top law enforcer of the country. And so that's also of a concern, I think, for many people, especially on the Democratic side especially.
Given those two issues that you just raised, the first, the race-related comments going back to 1986, but also the more recent issues, could any of that make his going more challenging?
Well, I think so. I mean, these questions will definitely be raised at the confirmation hearings, and the fact that the Democrats have 48 seats in the House in the Senate right now, you'd only need three Republicans to switch sides to defeat a nomination. And so, while I would have to say that's probably not extremely likely at this point, it's certainly possible, and it at least will be. These serious questions will be raised in the confirmation hearings.
And what about Sessions' position on immigration, both illegal and legal?
He's taken a very hard line on immigration, that he was a backer of Alabama state law that was eventually struck down by the U.S. Supreme Court. It was probably the harshest immigration law in the country, and Sessions strongly endorsed that. And so he's very much in line with Donald Trump's very strong, hard position on immigration with mass deportations. I think this will be something that he will be pursuing pretty aggressively as Attorney General.
David Cannon is with us right now. He's a professor of political science at UW-Madison, and we're talking about President-elect Donald Trump's picks for Attorney General, CIA Director, and National Security Advisor. And looking now at CIA Director, what can you tell us about the Kansas Congressman Mike Pompeo?
So he's a three-term member of Congress, a relatively junior compared to both Sessions and Flynn, who have a lot more experience in politics. So three terms, and is serving his sixth year right now from Kansas. Probably most well known for his work on the Benghazi Committee, very strong critic of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in the report from the committee that investigated the Benghazi incident. He issued a minority report that was much more strongly critical than the committee, which basically concluded that there was no illegal or improper activity that happened. There was, and so his minority report was not signed by other Republicans on the committee. Just, I believe, two people were on the minority report. So it was kind of the extreme sort of anti-Clinton position on that committee. He's also publicly opposed to the Iran deal, something that Donald Trump also has said that he is looking to getting rid of the Iran deal, and is also someone who's very strong, sees the Islamic threat as a very kind of strong threat. And so those are areas where the head of the CIA would clearly be having influence on all of those kinds of issues as the director of the Central Intelligence Agency.
And within the CIA, one area that Pompeo and Trump will likely look at is the use of controversial interrogation methods for terror suspects. And Trump has said that he approves the use of such methods, including waterboarding. So what would you expect to see in that particular direction?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I would guess that Pompeo would be open to some harsher tactics than were approved under the Obama administration. It depends on how moving forward whether Congress is willing to go along with that as well. So that's a little bit more of an open question, I think.
Now, finally, I want to talk about Lieutenant General Michael T. Flynn was picked to be National Security Advisor for Trump. What do we know about him so far?
So he was a former Defense Intelligence Agency director under President Obama, and was basically fired by Obama. Although you get different accounts exactly as to how. Why that happened, he was seen as having a very sort of strong managerial style that was trying to redirect the mission of that agency from more of a Washington-based focus to more overseas operations, and that met with some resistance internally, apparently. Since he has not been part of the Obama administration, he signed on relatively early with the Trump campaign. And during the campaign, CNN just ran a story earlier this afternoon showing the many dozen times that he retweeted things from the alt-right, like really sort of extremely sort of anti-Islam, very strong sort of anti-Semitic and really very inflammatory things that he was retweeting. In some cases, he said he didn't realize exactly what he was tweeting about and pulled them back. But in other cases, these sort of stayed out there on Twitter. And so I think there'll be questions raised about this in his confirmation hearing as well. To what extent are the views that he was engaging in during the campaign his actual views on foreign policy issues, and to what extent was he maybe just engaging in campaign rhetoric and not as sort of even aware of exactly what he was retweeting.
And David, what kind of reaction have Democrats had to these picks?
Well, I think Democrats are really very concerned that, again, this is clearly very the strong right wing of the Republican Party that's is being put forward for these very important positions. And they're saying that they're concerned not only with Sessions for Attorney General, but especially Flynn for National Security Advisor, that these are views that are outside the mainstream of politics and could shape our foreign policy in the case of Flynn and shape how our laws are enforced in the case of Jeff Sessions. So these are very important high-level positions that, again, I think will have very sort of strong scrutiny through the Senate confirmation process.
And just briefly before we let you go, the picks that we talked about today, they're all men, and I think that's what we've been seeing so far. Are there any women up for appointments?
Well, certainly a few have been talked about that there, you know, a couple, I mean, that again, Democrats wouldn't be terribly thrilled with, that you know, Sarah Palin for Interior is one that has been talked about. Michelle Rhee from Washington, D.C., the former controversial public schools superintendent in Washington, D.C., is very strong on school choice issues, talking about her for Department of Education, perhaps. And so then there are a few other names that have been mentioned floated for other positions, too, but those are probably two of the more prominent ones.
David, thanks a lot for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
That was David Cannon, professor of political science at UW-Madison, and he joined us there to talk about President-elect Trump's picks for his attorney general, CIA director, and national security advisor.
We take a look at the party that come January will have control of the White House, the Senate, and the House.
During the race for president, the Republican Party was seen as fractured, especially as prominent party leaders like House Speaker Paul Ryan were at odds with President-elect Donald Trump during the campaign. But our next guest says that Trump's victory has actually strengthened the Republican Party.
Fred Barnes joins us now. He's executive editor of the Weekly Standard and a Fox News contributor. His article, "Donald Trump Didn't Split the GOP, He Strengthened It," is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Fred, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
Well, yeah, a lot of the commentary leading up to the race was a divided future for the Republican Party. You're saying with the election outcome, with the way things are now, it's the party's way stronger thanks to Donald Trump. Make the case.
Well, he is. And look, I was one who didn't expect Trump to win. I thought Hillary Clinton would probably win. And I was as surprised as anybody that that Trump won. Well, here's what he did. Basically, he's conservative on most issues, not all of them, not on trade, for instance. But he put together the conservative agenda, basically, with this a populist agenda, and broadened the base of the party. One Pennsylvania, one Michigan, one Wisconsin, as you all are quite aware. One Ohio, one Iowa, won the Rust Belt. It's something that I've watched over the years writing about politics. Republicans have been unable to do in recent years. And after making huge efforts, I remember George W. Bush in 2004 tried to win Pennsylvania, just and came up short. Trump did it. Another thing is he had coattails. You know, in Pennsylvania, for instance, he not only won the state, but he pulled in Pat Toomey, the senator, a Republican senator there who wouldn't have won otherwise, but his coattails pulled Toomey in, and certainly helped in a number of other races, helped in House races. Republicans had so many vulnerable House members, and I happen to know that they expected a minimum of 15 House seats lost originally. Ultimately, how many did they lose? Six. So Republicans still have this huge number of House members. I think they're down now to 241, which is still one of the largest amounts they've had in recent decades. It wouldn't have happened without Trump. I know he won narrowly, but he lost particularly by huge numbers in states like New York and California. He lost by, 2.7 million votes in California, which is a lot. Look, this was a surprise to me. I didn't think Trump was going to do this, and yet he did. And I think, not surprised that others haven't written things similar to what I did, that he pulled together the Republican Party in a way that wasn't expected. Remember, the exit poll showed he got 90% of Republicans. I didn't think he was going to get to that, but he did.
Does it come at a cost on certain issues of principle? You mentioned he diverged from people like Paul Ryan on free trade. He's talking about a massive infrastructure spending program that a lot of Republicans would have called a make work, maybe a boondoggle kind of project in the past. Are Republicans losing something here?
Well, those are two different things, trade and infrastructure. On trade, I'm afraid that, and I happen to be a free trader myself, I think Trump won the argument. And sometimes I don't think he was accurate. I mean, he acts like the North American Free Trade Agreement, which was enacted under Bill Clinton in 1994, has devastated parts of the Rust Belt and upstate New York and places like that. I don't think there's much empirical evidence of that. But anyway, Trump won that argument. But on infrastructure, he sounded just like Hillary Clinton. Trump wants to spend $1 trillion, I think, on infrastructure. Republicans in Congress think, well, wait a minute. We just passed a huge highway bill. We passed a bill helping out the Federal Aviation Administration with spending the billions of dollars there to modernize it and so on, and on and on. They think they've spent a lot. They don't want to spend $1 trillion. This is something where I think Trump and Chuck Schumer, the new Democratic minority leader in the Senate, may come together, and it will. And Republicans are going to be very unhappy with it.
Well, I think you can make a case that that trade argument is a lot of what won Donald Trump states like Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania. The people who switched from Obama to Trump, those are the kind of things they were citing as to why they did it. Would you rather have a Republican president who, or a Democratic president for that matter, who had made a strong, compelling case for free trade and arguing with what you said was empirically flawed about trade and its impact?
Well, I think there's one thing about that candidate, Republican or Democrat, who made a big argument for free trade. That person would have lost. Clearly, it's just an argument that's hard to make now. Even though, and it's always been free trade's hard, been hard to make the argument for. But it was at one point the policy of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. But it's changed in both parties now, and that change has been really firmed up by the election of Donald Trump. No question about that. Here's the difference about Trump. You know, when I went into this election, and I was not hostile to Trump, but I didn't think he could win. I thought he was the one Republican, and many others thought this, the one Republican nominee who could not beat Hillary Clinton. I came out of the election thinking that he was the only Republican who could have beaten Hillary Clinton. He was the only one who was going to win Pennsylvania. Ohio, he might have won. Some other one might have won Ohio, but win Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. No other Republican could have done that. And without winning those states, if Trump hadn't done it, no other Republican could, and Hillary Clinton would be president.
Talking to Fred Barnes from the Weekly Standard, talking about his article, Donald Trump didn't split the GOP, he strengthened it. So you write, and a lot of people have noted, that Donald Trump broke a lot of what we thought were the rules of politics. If you imagine Mitt Romney or Barack Obama last time around saying a lot of the things that Donald Trump had said, you'd think it would have sunk them. You'd think these were non-starters. What did he do differently that actually made that work?
Well, one, he had a big personality. That certainly helped him in the primary debates when he, you know, the other Republicans were arguing about, well, who's the real true conservative? And Trump didn't. He didn't get involved in that. He just talked about what he wanted to do and insulted people and so on. Look, I can't explain how you can get away with that forever. A part of it is his opponent was a weak, turned out to be a very weak candidate without a message. Hillary Clinton did not have a message other than my opponent's unfit to be president. And, you know, there were a lot of people, and I talked to many of them, who just instinctively were drawn to Trump. And then, of course, others were drawn to him on the trade issue, on the immigration issue. People who were not reliable Republican voters, if they had ever voted Republican at all. I was up in Erie, Pennsylvania, you know, in the northwest corner of Pennsylvania, and sort of like one of these Rust Belt industrial states, the cities that sort of worn out now. They've lost a lot of their industry. In 2012, Obama won Erie by 14,000 votes. This election, Donald Trump won it by 2,500 votes. A huge reversal, and in order to do that, in order to have that reversal, Trump had to win a lot of people who were not Republicans. They may become Republicans, but they weren't in 2012, and they voted for Trump, the Republican candidate, in 2016.
I want to lay out some before and afters for prominent Republicans who now are enthusiastically supporting Donald Trump. Ted Cruz called him a pathological liar, quoting the man as utterly amoral. Scott Walker, our governor here, when he dropped out of the race, said, yeah, we need opposition, united opposition to the current frontrunner, Donald Trump. This is fundamentally important to the future of our party, he said. Chris Christie called Trump a carnival barker. The list goes on. Do Republicans pay a price for that stand then and then changing it now that Trump's won?
Well, it depends on one thing, and I thought you'd get that some of the things that Mitt Romney said. You know,
well, he didn't get to him, and he just met with Donald Trump, I believe. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, and all those things are, I would say, forgotten, mainly by Republicans, because of one thing: Trump won. Now, if Trump is a failure as president, if he acts like he did earlier in his campaign and is a loose cannon and is being distracted and so on, which he hasn't appeared to be. I mean, he wasn't in the final 3 weeks of the campaign, and he hasn't been in the transition here, but that's, you know, this isn't a very long time. But if he's a failure as president, if he gets us in foreign policy trouble, if he doesn't reassure the all our allies around the world in Asia and Europe and elsewhere, then I think some of those things will come back and will haunt him because they'll be repeated again. Trump right now is victorious, and that sort of wipes everything else away. But if he is a failure as president in, you know, the first couple of years, then I'm afraid that's going to be very harmful to the party and all this, and bringing unity to the party, as I think he has now, that will just be shattered.
Fred, briefly, we're just about out of time. Quick take mm-hmm. on appointments so far, cabinet and other.
Well, they're Trump. I mean, two of them. Certainly, Jeff Sessions at Justice is a Trump loyalist, the first senator who backed him. Mike Flynn is someone who is also very close to Trump. I don't think Congressman Pompeo, who is at the CIA, has been close to Trump. But they're all hardcore conservatives.
Fred, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I enjoyed it. Thanks for calling.
That's Fred Barnes. He's executive editor of the Weekly Standard, Fox News contributor. He told us why he believes President-elect Donald Trump's victory has strengthened the Republican Party. We've got a link to his piece on that topic over at the Central Time Facebook page. It's Food Friday, and we're gearing up for holiday season, which means lots of potlucks and gatherings with the important people in our lives, whether it's at work, church, or with friends. But what dish can you bring that's going to be okay sitting out on that table for a couple few hours?
We asked Food Friday regular Lori Skelton this very question, and she's been investigating different dishes leading up to today. And we want to hear from you, too, on this. What is your holiday potluck go-to recipe? What do you make that still tastes good at the end of that fun get-together? And what potluck recipe gets the most compliments? What's your secret? Call in now at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Lori's with us in the studio now. She's one of our in-house foodies at WPR and a Food Friday regular. Lori, good to talk to you again.
Good to be back.
Well, one of the challenges you decided to tackle here is you're not using a crock pot or anything like that. You're going to try to find something that's good and keeps well at room temperature. Why did you want that particular challenge?
Because I have been guilty of poisoning people at a potluck because I made something in a crock pot the night before, unplugged the crock pot, drove several hours to the event, plugged the crock pot in, and this was a dish that had eggs in it and dairy. Mm. It was a grain, but custard binding the grain, and I honestly thought that was safe. And oh boy, were we sick!
Wow, that's a cautionary tale, isn't it?
Yeah. What you should bank on if you are going to use a crock pot to keep something warm at a potluck, don't make it in the crock pot and then take it. Make the dish as hot as possible and then transport it to the venue, keeping it hot, and then put it in the crock pot once you get there. You have to keep your internal temperature of your food at least 140 degrees if it's a hot dish. And you should always think about, if you are going to serve something hot that has to be hot, 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 you have to take in your transportation time as well. You've really got about a 2-hour window. So if you can plan it so it's the last thing you do before you walk out the door is that you take that pot of food off the stove, then you've got some leeway, but you do have to be careful. So I really was on the lookout for things that you've got a bit of wiggle room.
So if you had made your dish in the crock pot, unplugged it, stuck it in the fridge so it had come down quite a bit in temperature, then transported it well chilled and reheated it there. Do you think that would have worked?
That's even something that a lot of food safety sites, foodsafety.gov, does not recommend you do that. So do plan. If you are planning on chilling something, find another way to heat it up again before you put it back in that crock pot. Just to be on the safe side.
Let's get into some ingredients. I'm not going to bring maybe my container of eggs and dairy in the car for a long time. What are some ingredients that hold up a little better, a little longer, safely for that potluck?
You need to be careful with cut fruit. So dried fruit is always a good idea. How you cook your vegetables can determine whether or not they're going to spoil a little faster. If you're roasting or pickling your vegetables to add flavor, that's a really great idea. What I found is that things that lean on beans, lentils, nuts, and grains will definitely give you more wiggle room. So the first thing to think about when you're taking something to a potluck is come up with a great grain salad that doesn't have a creamy dressing. Look for vinegars or good vinaigrettes. Use a lot of acidic fruits to dress your salads, and just go from there. Your main dish salad, starting with a grain, adding some good vegetables, and then if you want some protein, you can think about nuts. Or what's a real lifesaver for any potluck is a meat that's been cured in some way. Smoked sausages or pre-cooked kielbasa or cured ham, or what we'll talk about a little bit later, I'd never worked before, is salt cod. So look for things that have already been cooked if you're going for protein there, and add that to a composed, a grain salad.
Well, can you share a recipe that uses some of those things, those beans and legumes and an acidic dressing and dried fruit? It sounds pretty good together. What did you try with that one?
One thing that is a real favorite is a Martha Stewart favorite salad. She uses farro, but you could use something like barley or millet or quinoa or even pearl couscous, and she'll combine that nutty grain with golden raisins, with fresh fennel, mint, and she likes that real bitter radicchio. And her dressing for that salad is a mixture of lemon juice and honey. And honey is a really good preservative as well. If you don't like a green that's that bitter...
And I don't.
Okay. Arugula, chopped romaine would work really well. And if you want to add more protein, that's a good one for peanuts or pecans.
Sounds pretty good.
Yeah. And so that's just a basic thing to start with. You're to serve between 4 and 6, you're looking at a cup of grain... Or grain or rice or whatever that you're going to cook, and then you can use that as your basis and add as many vegetables and interesting things as you want.
And you could add, what, some smoked salmon, according to what you were saying? I was remembering one of the earlier dishes you made that I actually loved and keep meaning to make. It had goat cheese, but could you take that same smoked salmon and put it in this farro salad?
Smoked salmon would work. I see a lot of people using cold poached salmon in composed salads on buffets. I'm not exactly sure that's entirely safe at room temperature, but if you know that when you get there you can put it in a shallow bowl and set that shallow bowl in a bigger shallow bowl on a bed of ice, there you're safe. But definitely smoked salmon is a good one, and if you can keep an eye on it, cold poached salmon is another good way to add protein.
It is Food Friday. We're getting ready for potluck season with Lori Skelton. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a potluck go-to? Do you need some ideas? What do you do to make sure the food you have out on the table stays safe and fresh? Call in at 800-642-1234. Lori, I understand you had some leftover kale from your garden this year, a good timely thing, and you did something to make it a little more appropriate for a potluck kind of recipe.
I never thought of using kale as the green for a pesto. But if you can blanch kale, or if you have leftover kale, if you throw that in your blender or your food processor, again, with some nuts, garlic, lemon, extra virgin olive oil, you toss that with some boiled... You want a fat shape of pasta here. Penne is a good one, or radiatore. And then throw that in with, again, roasted vegetables, roasted butternut squash. Ooh. as a way. And the original recipe I looked at, Didn't say this was a room temperature dish, but I ended up eating the leftovers for breakfast at room temperature the next morning, and it was magnificent. So we think about pasta salads a lot with mayonnaise, and of course mayonnaise can be problematic on a buffet table as well. So rework your favorite pasta salads so you don't need a creamy dressing, and see what you can do with vegetables there.
And you said blanch the kale first, and blanching, that's hot water just very briefly and then cold?
30 seconds and then drain it. And
that breaks down some of that toughness in the kale, I imagine.
But it still keeps it bright green and makes it that much easier to throw in the food processor. And you're right, you won't have quite that ropey texture from the middle.
And I noticed when you were giving that pesto recipe, you did not include cheese, which is usually a component of, you know, basil pesto. Was that intentional? You're trying to just take all the dairy right out of it?
It was intentional for this particular program, oddly enough, that it wasn't really something that was called for in the original recipe that I saw. I think this one was from the New York Times. But yeah, now there's something with a harder cheese like Parmesan. That's not going to spoil as rapidly. So if you want to be absolutely safe, you make your pesto without the cheese and then just serve it with the cheese on the side.
Ah, there you go.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Jessica in Oak Alley. Jessica, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about?
I actually have a cream cheese dip. I put the cream cheese and cinnamon and mix that together, and then you make a gel out of cranberries for Thanksgiving, and then once that's hot, you pour it over the top of the cream cheese and it gels over. And usually I just freeze that before I travel. I've never had any problems with it. And we travel so far that after, you know, it's sitting and it's been frozen, then it, you know, it will thaw out, and it's perfect for
It thaws out just in time for where when you get there.
Right, exactly.
So when you say you make a cranberry gel, how are you? Are you grinding the cranberries and then cooking them down? How are you doing that?
Usually I just, you know, put the cranberries in with a little bit of water, some sugar, and then boil it on the stove, much like you might for like a jelly or something.
Okay.
And then while it's still hot, I pour it over the, you know, I let it cool a little bit, but it's in a liquid form, and then I let it, I pour it over the cream cheese, and it gels up, and then you're able to freeze it. And
I'm really intrigued by this, Jessica.
What
do you dip in it? Like carrots, or is it a sweet dip?
It's more of a sweet dip. I usually use crackers or pretzels, so it gives it kind of like a sweet and salty.
Oh, that sounds good. Yeah.
I love that idea. That's really cool.
Thank you so much, Jessica. Is sweet dip a thing? You're saying that like it's like that's a category. But or did we
I
just
think
invent
sweet dips,
that?
I've seen pumpkin dips, for instance, around Halloween, and well, and you can
right,
do
no,
it now too.
I get that it's a concept, but is it a like a category? Sweet dip.
I want it
to be one. We're going to make it one.
I've seen it once where it was at a dessert buffet, and you had like little shortbread sticks of cookie that you could dip in lots of different dips.
In sweet dips.
Yes.
Some people might call it fondue, but no, I guess that's something entirely different.
Nope.
Okay. Well, we're talking to Food Friday regular Lori Skelton about potluck dishes as we get ready for holiday potluck season.
Taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Do you have suggestions for great potluck recipes that are good and safe? They hold up at room temperature for a while. Do you have questions about what to make maybe for a Thanksgiving or post-Thanksgiving potluck coming up or beyond into the holidays? Call in now, 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Find a recipe that we'll talk about coming up.
We're continuing our discussion about great potluck dishes with our Food Friday regular, Lori Skelton.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a recipe that you always like to bring to potlucks or like to find at potlucks and then eat after someone else makes it? What is your favorite potluck food? What secrets do you have for bringing a potluck dish that works at that room temperature? Still good after it sits out for a little while. Do you have questions? Do you need some inspiration? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Lori, one thing you suggest is savory pies.
Mm-hmm.
And this gets us toward the recipe you provided. But what do you like about this idea about making a savory pie, not a sweet one?
The idea that one, it's safe to serve this one at room temperature, and you can get wonderful fillings that are a little bit more compact. I'm not talking about something like a pot pie that has gravy. I'm thinking more along the lines of the pork pies that you would have found in Britain. Small pork pies are very popular in lunch boxes, so you don't have to worry about the temperature there. And, of course, here in southern Wisconsin, if you're looking towards Mineral Point, we all know what a pasty is.
Yep.
I just got back from Superior. We all know what a pasty is. And hand pies these days are incredibly fun and trendy. You can make a whole bunch of different flavors, have hand pies out on your buffet, and everybody can take their choice.
Yum.
One other lovely thing that savory pies will lend themselves to, if you're not someone who's good with pie crust, take a tip again from Britain and make what is called a hot water crust. And this is where you take a pan of water and melt into it sometimes straight butter, sometimes a combination of butter and lard. And you take that water, mix your flour into it, and this will give you a dough that you don't have to worry about overworking. Mm. It's supposed to be warm, it's supposed to be malleable, and if you're not used to working with pie crust, it's a really great way to get started. It does make a sturdy crust. It's not going to be as flaky. It's going to be a little bit mealier, but it does hold fillings, especially if it's animal protein inside, holds those fillings in beautifully.
Let's get to one of those fillings, Lori. We've got it up on the Central Time Facebook page. Salt cod with tomatoes and capers.
Okay,
and this is, we're filling a pie with this. Or no, this is a different one.
This is a different one.
Okay, this is not in the pie.
What I did for the pie that was a real hit, what the initial recipe was ground pork and sliced apples. And part of the fun of this, I didn't use a hot water crust. I used a regular crust, but I put cheddar cheese and a lot of sage in that. And I was thinking, with a pie that had that kind of a flavorful crust, you wouldn't want to put too much seasoning in with the pie. That is a mistake, especially if you know you're going to be serving something at room temperature. Go ahead and dump a little bit more spice into it. This was pork spiced with cinnamon and ginger and nutmeg and allspice, and I ended up doubling the amount of spices in the original recipe.
Sounds kind of medieval.
Yeah.
It is. It
420 Blackbird style.
Almost, but again, especially if you're going to be serving something at room temperature, you're going to need that extra flavor to carry. And from that basic recipe, I also tried a vegetarian version using apples, leeks, and mushrooms. The filling was delicious, but because I tried making a gluten-free crust with that one, the crust was a disaster, so I did not bring that in for anybody to share.
Let's take a caller now, and we've got Winthrop with us in Genoa City. Winthrop, hi.
Hi. I really liked what you were talking about with the savory pies at a potluck, and it made me think of one thing that I like to make is a spanica pita, those little Greek phyllo dough filled with spinach and cheese. And the thing that I like about them is that the phyllo dough stays really crisp at room temperature. Sometimes you make things with crust, and the crust will go soggy if it's not hot, but the phyllo dough stays really crispy. And the cheese in it, you can put feta cheese in it. I like putting goat cheese in it sometimes, and that cheese stands nicely at room temperature, too, so it's not something that you really have to worry about. And they're always nice when they're hot, but when they start to cool off and they've, you know, been sitting out at room temperature, they still taste really amazing.
Yeah, and sometimes the flavor gets even better. That's actually one of my favorite dishes of all time and a potluck favorite, but it's got cheese in it, Lori.
It's got cheese in it, so as long as you know that this is going to be either eaten very quickly, or do this. When you get to your spot at the potluck, cut your dish in half. If you've got a whole tray of spanakopita, cut it in half, put half of it out on the buffet, and then put half of it in the refrigerator. And if people want more, throw it in the oven, heat it up, get it to the proper temperature, and then put that second tray out.
Sounds fantastic, Winthrop. Thanks a lot. Well, I teased it, Lori. Now let's get to this. It's not a pie filling. I can't be more clear about this. The recipe on our Central Time Facebook page this week, salt cod with tomatoes and capers. I could fill a pie with this if I wanted to. But tell us about this recipe.
This was the recipe that made me so happy. It was the first time I've ever worked with salt cod. I've heard about it all my life, just never had the urge to try it. Salt cod is used in cultures all over, wherever you've got access to the fish. It shows up in the Caribbean, in Greek dishes, Spain, Portuguese, French, Scandinavian. One person who was commenting on the recipe that I found online said that she ate this for breakfast in Trinidad. And salt cod is a way of preserving that fish. When you soak it to get some of the salt out, you end up with a fish that has a chewier texture and a milder taste than regular cod. And in Italy, Christmas Eve is very often given over to a buffet of seafood dishes. It's a little bit of abstinence before you start tucking into the real heavy stuff for Christmas Day dinner. They have what they call the Feast of the Seven Fishes, and salt cod in a spicy tomato sauce is one of the highlights of that Christmas Eve celebration. So I used Mario Batali's version. He calls it bacala, salt cod, a la Vesuviana. And so his tomato sauce was a little bit spicier, had a lot of capers in, so a fair amount of robust spices in it. And this was one that I brought for the Halloween potluck for Wisconsin Public Radio. I took it off the stove at 10:45 in the morning. The potluck brought people in at noon. Now, I deliberately kept back one piece of fish in tomato sauce that I told myself I would try later, and I ate it at 2:30, so hours after I took it off the stove, no ill effects whatsoever. This is one that I feel is very, very safe to be served at room temperature. If you don't have a chafing dish, if you don't have access to a crock pot, this would be a great thing to make. Once you've soaked your fish, it comes together in about 10 minutes.
You've soaked your... I don't know anything about salt cod. So wait, okay. So does this mean you take a fillet of uncooked fish, then you soak it in salt, which...
You buy salt cod.
It's pre-salted.
Yeah, that's how you preserve it. And so you soak it in clear, cool water. And depending on your particular brand, you may have to soak it for a day, changing the water. You may have to soak it for two.
Is it dried?
It feels a little spongy. Yes, technically it's dried and salted as a preservative, but it's not dry like leather is dry.
It's not cod jerky.
No.
Okay. Sounds great, though.
Work on that. I know you can make salmon jerky, but haven't tried it with cod. And there's another thing. Mario Batali's basic recipe, which we will have up on the Facebook page, this is going to be a great base. You can add potatoes if you want. You can use olives instead of capers. Some people want to put raisins in for sweetness. If you don't have to worry about the room temperature aspect, salmon and haddock as a fresh fish or even fresh cod is another great addition to it. I just love this dish.
Well, Lori, thank you so much for being with us today and sharing the inspiration with us.
My pleasure. This should get you through the holidays.
Been talking to Lori Skelton, one of our in-house foodies here at WPR and a Food Friday regular. You can find that recipe we were just talking about. It is salt cod with tomatoes and capers. You can sub in the olives. It's a little spicy on the Central Time Facebook page and on WPR.org. While you're there, maybe share some of your potluck favorites. So I don't know, are you gonna run and try this salt cod?
I don't know. I think I'm more into the pie thing. Yeah. I like the savory pie idea, and I like the idea of, like Lori calls them, hand pies. And I think I might give that a go.
Sounds like a lot of work.
It does, but now we have the new pie crust technique, which could make it easier.
That's true. I'm curious about that. Again, share your favorite potluck ideas and find that recipe for the salt cod. Head over to the Central Time Facebook page. News came out this week that this year's White House Christmas tree is a gift from Wisconsin.
The tree comes from the Whispering Pines Tree Farm in Oconto near Green Bay, and it's set to arrive at the White House by horse-drawn carriage and will be presented to the First Lady the day after Thanksgiving.
Sounds like a cool tree. It's a mix between a Fraser fir, which I understand is your tree of choice.
Always, yeah.
That, a Fraser fir, and a kind of Japanese fir tree.
Right, and this particular tree, it's a pretty tall tree. It's about 19 feet tall, and its eventual destination is a room in the White House called the Blue Room, which is evidently an oval-shaped parlor on the first floor.
It's a big building. You need a big tree. Like 19 feet, I mean, in my house, you'd be cutting holes in the floor, which I've seen done, actually. A relative of my wife's, she'd bought a house, and the previous occupants had put a hole in their ceiling of their living room for the sole purpose of fitting in a ginormous Christmas tree.
Wow, I have not seen that. That's commitment.
It's a two-story tree.
That's commitment.
Yeah, and this horse-drawn carriage, as I understand it, it's not actually going by horse from Oconto to Washington,
D.C. Yeah, I think it might be a little late.
Yeah, it's a little, I-80 might see a bit of a slowdown, I think, with
the horse-drawn carriage. Like a very lovely ceremonial kind of thing, and I know that the folks who own Whispering Tree Pines Farm are really excited about this.
Yep, a bit of Wisconsin in the White House. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.